On May 20, 2010, the Rockport Conservation Commission sponsored a forum on generating electricity through wind power. The meeting was held at the Rockport Opera House. Speakers included State Senator Chris Rector, Dr. Richard Podolsky, an ecologist, Habib Dagher of the University of Maine's Deep Sea Wind Consortium, Suzanne Pudy of the Maine Community Wind Island Institute, Des Fitzgerald of the Camden Energy Committee. There was also a question and answer period held. The meeting was opened by Rockport Conservation Commission Chairman Ted Skowronski.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Ted Skowronski. I'm the chairman of the Rockport Conservation Commission. And I'd like to welcome you all here. Thank you for coming, spending some time with us. I believe we have this is an educational forum. So the idea behind it, and one of the things we decided on being a commission, is that we want the public to start to learn about various energies and other things that can be done. So we are starting off with the wind power, and that's why it's wind harvesting in Maine. I believe we have some very good experts to do the perfect presentations. What I'd like to do, again, we'll have approximately an hour and 15 minutes of the presentations being done. And I ask that you hold off any kind of questions or anything until they're all completed. At that stage, we will do a question and answer period. And I'd like it if someone comes up, you ask one question, and then allow someone else to ask the question. We don't want anybody trying to hog the seat. And we'll just keep rotating people that way. So just feel free to write your questions down. If you don't mind, I'll be passing around a pad asking so we could create a list of people and their email so we could notify people ahead of time when we're planning on doing some other forums. And if you find this forum to be exciting, please let us know because I'd like to be able to, one of the conceptions that I have is that we would be able to expand this and do it as an expo where we could bring in other alternative energy people and people who are opposed to it, let them have their table so we could have a one-on-one session. So we're trying to be as democratic as we can. And on that note, I'll turn it over to Richard Podolsky. He will be one of our first presenters, and he'll also be the moderator. Thank you, Richard.
Great. Can everyone hear me okay? Are you picking me up on the mic?
Yeah.
First of all, I want to acknowledge Ted. He's been on the Rockport Conservation Commission for over a year, and he's now in charge of the Rockport Conservation Commission. This was really his idea to create a forum where we can start talking about energy issues, and they're huge issues. I don't know how many of you are tracking the oil down in the Gulf of Mexico and the coal hearings that are going on in the Congress. We are, as a nation, as a world, and even here locally, we're in a transition from one type of energy production to another. And any time you transfer between energy sources or transfer between any types of technologies, it can be painful and a little bit confusing. So I think Ted had a great idea to make this the first of a forum where we're really just available to answer some questions and just get some discussion going. There's a lot happening just in Maine. And what we've attempted to do in the list of speakers here is to just give you a thumbnail view of some of the things going on at the political level, at the university, at the level of the university with offshore energy, some of the local projects on the project on Vinyl Haven. For those of you who are just driving down Route 1 and looking across the bay, you've seen the project there. And you're maybe familiar with other projects around the state of Maine. And then right in Camden has a energy committee. Des will be speaking on that. And I just found out from Mike there's a energy committee in Rockland. So there's a lot happening. And there's a lot to get involved with. And it's all available and open to the public. And you can get on the email list to the extent that you want, you can get involved in the whole area. So, as Ted mentioned, this is the first of a series. We're I don't know on what frequency. Some of that will depend on the input we get from folks about how much more information they want and how frequently they want it. But I like the idea of maybe quarterly, every 3 or 4 months anyway, we gather again and take the topic to another level. We're going to actually just talk in the order that's listed here. So our state senator from District 22, Chris Recker, will start out. I'll go next and talk about some of the environmental issues. I happen to work in this industry. And Suzanne Pudi is at the Island Institute, very involved in the Island Wind Project out in Vinalhaven and Monhegan. And Habib is our leader at the University of Maine and is doing great things up there. And he'll have good things to say. And Des is in charge of the Energy Committee. Des Fitzgerald is in charge of the Energy Committee at in Camden. And there's some very interesting things going on. I mean, one of the things is we're not here to advocate or even talk about specific projects. But everyone, if you haven't heard, you know, just in the rumor mill, there's a discussion about looking at the Camden Hills and the Ragged Mountain as a possible place to do some wind power. It's a very early stage project. It has just been discussed. So while that's not the focus of this meeting, just understand that it is just underneath the surface, because we will have local decisions to make about renewable energy and where we want to go as a community, and everybody's voice is equal. So the last thing, Ted, we don't want to forget. This is a little bit of a story. Rockport Conservation Commission is it two empty spots?
Yes.
Or three? We are a skeleton crew. We need three people to join us. Sally's here, Jim Talfon, Steve McAllister. Raise your hand if you're on the Rockport Conservation Commission. So that's us.
Steve McAllister, you know, Sally Cook.
We're a pretty fun group. We meet once a month, and we could use anybody and anybody who's interested in joining us. So that was another.
Thank you. You're right. I forgot all about that. And you don't. One of the things is you don't have to be a tree hugger. You don't have to. You know, as long as you have a great mind, you're willing to, you know, get your hands dirty and things, you know, and take a project in your hands if you want. We've had some exciting projects, and we have a lot more that we'd like to do. And the trouble is, without having the people, it's hard to do. So. You have it on the agenda. My name and phone number is on there. Please be giving me a call, and we would like to have you at a meeting and see what we're all about.
It's about an hour a month, so it's a very, and it's a good thing. And you get to, you know, be involved in and hear what's going on in the towns. So with that, Chris, if you don't mind, just
thank you.
Jumping in, and if you want to add anything to the very brief bio, feel free.
No. That's fine. I'm Chris Rector. I represent Senate District 22, which is most of Knox County, and I'm proud to do that in the Maine Senate, just ending my first term. And I want to thank you for the invitation to be here, and thanks to all of you for coming. I think this is an important topic. I'm going to speak really briefly because I think there are people with much more to add, and I know the time is fairly short. And Habib, I've heard his presentations many times, and he could fill this hour and a half on his own with no problem. Let me just say that Maine is, I think, actually I'll start with, you know, I was just at a meeting the other day with Angus King, and he said there was a wind spill up on Mars Hill, and there were people up there flying kites and throwing frisbees trying to. He said, tough to kick the oil guys when they're down, but a little hard not to, too. I'd say Maine is committed to long-term energy change, and looking, I would say, at a variety of answers to our energy needs. I don't think there's any one focus. I think there are a range of things that are being discussed, from LNG to wind to tidal and many things in between. But we recognize that we have the oldest housing stock in the nation. We are enormously dependent on fossil fuels for heating our homes. And We also pay the among the highest costs in the nation for electricity, and it becomes a real drag on the ability for our economy to thrive and for our manufacturing to be successful. With that in mind, there is a new Efficiency Maine Trust that has been formed that is sort of the focus of all state dollars that are coming in from a variety of resources. And that trust is they've developed a triennial plan. And the plan includes the weatherization of 100% of Maine's homes and 50% of Maine's businesses by 2030. Fairly ambitious. Perhaps not achievable, but I think we certainly need to reach boldly, I think, if we're going to change the direction we've been going in. We're also looking to achieve 30% savings of electric and natural gas consumption and 20% fuel oil reduction by 2020. So we've got some goals out there in a variety of ways to achieve those. Perhaps the most important thing that I could tell you all is if you haven't visited the Efficiency Maine website, I would encourage you to do so. There are a host of tips that you can use in your own homes. There are programs that are available, including the opportunity to receive some grant money for replacement of appliances that are not energy efficient. They talk a little bit about the kilowatt monitors that are available at your local library. You can bring those home and check out which appliances you have that are perhaps not particularly efficient. There are a variety of things going on. We need, I think we need to be focused on not choosing winners and losers in the energy field, but being open-minded about what might work best. We are fortunate that the investments that Maine has made in research and development, especially at the university and especially at Habib's lab, are beginning to pay dividends, I think, and specifically will be paying dividends in the potential for offshore wind energy in a way that we maybe couldn't even imagine when those first investments were made as we were developing the lab. I think that speaks to a commitment of public dollars continuing in research and development if we're going to be successful in meeting our long-term energy needs and being successful in making the changes that we are anticipating. So with that, I will pass the mic to whoever is next. And thank you for the chance to speak.
I'm going to focus my comments just on the environmental issues that surround wind power. For the last 6 years, my day job is going to proposed wind power project sites and doing the biological surveys to document the sites and make sure that projects are not going to be built in biological hotspots where they can be a problem. So one of the things that I thought I would be able to, what I would try to do in a few minutes is paint that picture for you. But let me take one step back and explain that wind power developers, whether it's a municipality that develops a wind project or a private developer, these are capital-intensive projects. They are at best marginally productive right now. They're just getting to a point where they can compete toe-to-toe with other forms of energy. So just beginning to get them so that they can really be done. They are, from an engineering standpoint, they can be very demanding. From an environmental standpoint, there are many hurdles. So somebody who enters the wind power industry, they are entering some of the more complicated projects to pull off. The list of your checklist of things that you have to take care of to successfully see a project through conception, to see it go online, is incredible. So anybody who you know or any project that you hear about that goes online, these have been some of the most challenging projects. So I'm not going to talk about the engineering challenges, which in some cases, some of these projects go into very rugged country and ridges and around New England. And there's a whole host of things there. Maybe in future meetings, we'll bring somebody to really, from Chinbro or Reed, or somebody who can really tell you, drill into that for you. The same is true on the financial modeling side. What you need to do to have your project at the end of the day, it must be profitable and beneficial. Somebody has to make some money. I'm not going to get into that. So I want to talk about the environmental issues. They're right there. They're potential showstoppers. There's so many things along the way in a wind power project that can party over. Everybody goes home. And if, for instance, if there are very organized people who are against the project for whatever reason, and if it's just the public is not interested in the project, that can be significant. We've had there's examples of that from all over the country. So one of the things that I've been able to do through my work on over 60 wind power projects is I've seen from California, I worked on 3 projects in Hawaii. I've worked on over 20 projects in Texas. Texas is really the front line of wind power, and many other western states. So I know what's involved with the environmental issues. And I'll just list some of the things that we take that fall under that category. I mentioned the visual. Sound issues are very important and increasingly so. That falls under kind of environmental issues, and we'll hear more about that. Cultural resources, especially in the western states, but even here in Maine, you have to do surveys for archaeological, indigenous artifacts and the like. That falls under that. Birds, bats, and wildlife. That's my actual expertise. I first came to Maine and studied seabirds on the Outer Islands when I was in college, and that's my focus on wind power project is the ornithology. If you're doing a coastal marine project, offshore wind, there's marine mammal issues, and what the work entails, we do pre-construction surveys. This is before a project is approved to make sure that we are avoiding critical resources. In particular, threatened and endangered species, we've got to avoid those. So we do pre-construction surveys. They can be a monthly survey, and they can be for several years if it's a very sensitive area. After a project is built, many projects are required to do post-construction monitoring to see how the project's doing. So in pre-construction, we'll go out and count the birds and the wildlife and see what's there. And we have ways of scoring whether or not it's a high priority area, an important area, or it's just a regular area and can deal with some kind of impact. Post-construction, we actually walk underneath the turbines and we look for downed wildlife and quantify them. Why do we do this work? It's legally required. The Migratory Bird Treaty Act protects all migratory birds. It's a treaty between the U.S. and Canada. It dates back to 1918. It's a zero-tolerance law. We cannot kill, it's not supposed to kill any birds. The Endangered Species Act from 1974, that has a high cost to it if you do harm to an endangered species. And then offshore, we have things like the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So, and really, for the work I do, the environmental work, the end user is actually state and federal agencies for the most part. I'm hired by developers. I do the work on their behalf, but at the end of the day, the work is evaluated and approved by consulting agencies. They have to, at the end of the day, they have to be happy. So, that's how we do this. And how the projects are performing. Now, wind power, of all the ways to manufacture electrons, wind power is probably the best. In that, its actual footprint, its ecological footprint, from a life cycle analysis, almost any way you want to analyze it and compare wind power as a way to manufacture electrons compared to burning coal, burning natural gas, burning any fossil fuels, wind power comes out ahead. But I'm here to tell you that it's not a zero impact. You cannot convert energy without having there be an environmental impact. So a wind power project puts a road, very often has to put its own road grid in. The turbine foundation areas must be cleared, so you're clearing vegetation. It results in some amount of fragmentation of ecosystems, which can degrade an area. And turbines can, if there's a high throughput of birds will run into these things. Now, the national average is between 3 and 7 birds per turbine per year. Now, a house cat on a good day can take half five birds. So, and skyscrapers, they're very big numbers in urban areas. So there are birds colliding with buildings. So there's a lot of things out in the built environment that's worse than wind power, but we do worry about it. We have a lot of wind turbines increasingly. I mean, I don't know what the number is nationwide now, but that number adds up. Even if you're on the low end of that, and we have a couple of 100,000 wind turbines operating in the U.S., and each one of them averages 3 a year. It's not zero, but it is. So it's a choice. It's a choice we make as a society, and that's pretty much what I wanted to mention. And feel free to ask questions at some point. Suzanne, would you like to talk about?
Sure. I'm driving a lot of today, so I think I'll stand up and move around a little bit. Okay, we'll get started. I'm just going to give you a brief overview of the Island Institute and why we're involved in community energy projects. I'll talk a little bit about the community wind model, which is the model that we're working on. Talk about how that applies to the case study for tonight, the Fox Islands Wind Project, the three-phase process that we applied in developing that project. Some of the lessons that we've learned thus far, and how this process that we've developed might be replicated in other communities. And then I'll offer up some conclusions. Next slide. So the Island Institute, you might be familiar with. We're located right down the street in Rockland, a 26-year-old nonprofit organization. We seek to help sustain the island and coastal communities here in Maine. At the turn of the last century, there were more than 300 islands with year-round communities, and now there are only 15. There are a number of increasing challenges to surviving or continuing to live on island communities. The affordable housing is a severe issue. The fisheries that the communities depend on and the price that they're getting for fishing is an issue. And we have been hearing increasingly from our island partners and community leaders that energy costs are increasingly threatening the vitality of these 15 year-round communities. This is easy to understand when you take a look at the next slide, which is a graph of electricity rates from 2008. And as we said a little bit earlier, Senator Director noted that Maine is paying New England is paying sort of the highest electricity rates as far as the region. Maine is right up there in 2008, as is right now. We're roughly 9 cents a kilowatt hour for electricity. For the national average, Maine is roughly around 15 cents. And then we have the islands, which range from the Fox Islands in 2008, we're paying 28 cents a kilowatt hour, all the way up to Monhegan Island, which is paying right now 70 cents a kilowatt hour for their power. It's more than 7 times the national average, and what we figure to be probably the top 20 highest in the country. There's really no place else in this country that pays more for power than Monhegan does than rural villages in Alaska. So obviously this is a concern for our constituents, for our partners on the island, and it's been an interesting thing for those partners to take a look at the coastal wind resource map, which, go to the next slide, many islanders don't need to look at a map, nor do people here on the coast to understand that the winds blow pretty hard. As you see, the darker reds, the further you go from the coast, the more robust the wind resource is. And as you might hear from Habib or anybody else that can talk about wind power, is that small increases in wind speed result in large increases in power production. It's actually by a factor of a cube. So the farther out you go, the better wind speeds, the more power you're going to produce. And so this was not lost on the island communities. And back in 2007, when we first started to hear about these concerns about energy costs, a number of the islands told us that they were interested in looking at wind power, harvesting this wind resource as a way to lower their high energy costs. Want to go to the next slide? What became clear pretty early on, though, is that if there was going to be a wind project on the islands, 10 miles, 12 miles, even more than that, out in the middle of the ocean, it would need to be a project that came from the community, that the communities controlled, that the communities benefited from. These communities are used to being self-reliant and independent, and they don't want a developer to come out, put something up, get on the ferry, and say, see ya. So the conversation quickly turned to models that would enable that level of participation, ownership, and benefit, which what we call the community wind model. Community wind is quite popular in Europe as far as an ownership model, as a development model. In the U.S., though, due to the way that the federal incentives have been structured, community wind makes up less than 5% of the installed wind capacity in the country. There are models of various sorts. It means different things to different people, but to us at the Island Institute, these are some of the things that we emphasize. First and foremost, a co-location of costs and benefits, which is basically to say that to do a community wind project, a community is going to need to bear the cost of putting a project together, getting it through permitting, paying for it, looking at it, listening to it, and maintaining it as the project is up and operating. But that at the end of the day, they get to reap the benefits of owning it, controlling it, and benefiting in terms of reduced rates. In our community wind model, we really emphasize public participation throughout the process in development and post-construction and during operation. I'll talk a bit about that. We do emphasize careful management of project costs. Many communities have very limited resources to look into community wind projects and to develop them. And so the way that we structure the development process is one that really respects those limitations and the available capital to put together projects like this. And we do try to emphasize sizing the projects to meet the community's needs and not emphasizing on putting up large projects with an emphasis on exporting power. So the case study of the night is the Fox Islands project, which I'm sure most of you have heard quite a bit about. We're up here in Rockport, out in the middle of the bay. Next slide. We do have the Fox Islands of Vinyl Haven and North Haven. Next slide. Last year, the Island Institute worked with Fox Islands Electric Co-op and Fox Islands Wind and the Vinyl Haven and North Haven communities to put together a 4.5 megawatt community wind project that consists of three GE 1.5 megawatt turbines. Wasn't an easy project for this small community to do. It was $14.5 million with some innovative financing that we put together. $5 million came from a tax equity investment from a local Maine company, and $9.5 million came from a low-interest loan from the Rural Utility Service, which is a part of the USDA. The 4.5 megawatt project is projected to generate about 11,600 megawatt hours per year. Over the course of the year, the islands are connected to the mainland by a submarine cable. Over the course of the year, there are days when the wind is blowing like crazy and they're sailing to the mainland grid. There are days when the wind's going to be dead calm and there are a lot of people on the island in the summer. They're going to be buying from the mainland grid. But over the course of the years, the 11,600 megawatt hours is roughly about what the two communities use. Next slide. As I mentioned before, this project is developed, owned, and operated by Fox Islands Wind LLC, which in a few years will be formally a subsidiary of the 2,000-member Fox Islands Electric Cooperative. And it was the co-op that started all of this project and basically posed the question to the community back in July of 2008, do you guys want to do this? The result of that vote was 382 in favor and 5 against moving forward with the project. And so at that point, the co-op said, how do we do this? Next slide. So how do we do this? How do we get here? These are the three turbines up on Vinyl Haven. How did we get them across the bay? How do we pay for them? How did it all work out? Well, next slide. We put together a three-phase process to basically look at all those issues about community involvement, limited capital resources, making the tough decisions that need to be made, and informing the community. So phase one, we call the initial feasibility stage. The idea here is not to answer all the questions that you would ever want to know about a community wind project before it would go up. The idea is to spend some money, but not a ton of money, because you don't want to go out and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to answer questions before the community is even asked if they want to ask those questions. So for about $50,000, $60,000, the electric co-op was able to raise some funds to look into three areas of feasibility. The first one is technical and logistical feasibility. How can you get turbines to Vinyl Haven? Is there a place to put them? How will you erect them? Then there was a whole set of environmental questions, which Richard helped us to look at. What will the impact be to the surrounding environment, in terms of wildlife, as well as to residents, in terms of shadow flicker, sound, and other issues? Third, we look at the economic and financial feasibility. Economic in terms of how much would this cost, how much would this affect the sky-high electricity rates that we're paying. And financial in terms of how are we going to finance this thing. $14.5 million is a lot of money for a small community to come up with. So over the course of, you know, roughly 6-9 months, you know, the idea is to ask these questions, come to the community on several occasions, share the information that we've gathered thus far, and say, we don't have all the answers, but this is what it's looking like it's going to be. Do you want to do this or not? And give the community real veto power. If things don't look like this is a good idea, then don't. We're not going to go and do it. We're not going to spend the hundreds of thousands of dollars it will cost to get a project permitted. But if there's support, then it makes it, you know, we've already started in that direction to move on to phase two, which is what we call pre-development. The idea there is it will cost several hundred thousand dollars to get all of the work done for permitting, to do the micro-siting, to figure out how you're going to finance this thing. And it's not something that's easy for the community to be able to carry those couple hundred thousand dollars. So we worked together with Vinyl Haven and North Haven community to come up with a model where we were able to find interested community members who were interested and supportive of the idea of the project, who had the financial resources to help out a little, and ask those individuals to make what we call contingent promissory notes, basically saying that they would lend money to the project for pre-development purposes and receive a payback on their investment if the project got through permitting and was constructed. But if the project didn't make it through permitting, they wouldn't get their money back. They would be forfeit. We were able to raise roughly $300,000, I think, in doing that, and it basically made it so that the community still was investing in it, but it wasn't necessarily a burden borne by taxpayers. Fortunately, those investors are seeing a return on their investment. The project was constructed, is currently operating, and we made it through phase three, which I have, if you want to go forward, some photos. Next. You may have seen this photo. These are the 123-foot-long blades out on a barge in the middle of Penobscot Bay. You can see we've got an SUV here and some guys from Brock Marine, so they're quite large blades. So this is when the blades were arriving on Vinyl Haven down in Carver's Harbor, and it was an interesting day. There were probably 100 people gathered down there to cheer on the arrival of the blades. When the story is that when the truck driver here pulled off the wharf, everybody started clapping, and the guy driving the truck is, you know, works for a specialized trucking company that moves these things all over the country. He said, I've never had anyone clap for me before. So this was, you know, very much a very exciting project. Next. On September 1st, we erected the first section of the first turbine tower, putting into place right there. After the tower sections were up, the massive crane put the nacelle, which holds the generator and the gearbox, up on top. And then the hub was assembled down on the ground where the blades fit into the hub. And you want to go through the next few photos, raised right up. And you can see there's people actually up there that were getting the standing there to help position the hub in place. That was what they looked like right before commissioning. That's why they're not facing in the right direction. They weren't operating at the time. And before they started operating, I did get the chance to climb up there myself. The next picture, I think, is there. Pretty good view from up there. If you can handle the climb going up roughly 3.5 feet, it's not a bad view. Okay. So what have we learned from putting up this project, going through this three-phase process? What can other communities learn from this? Well, first, we talked about the financing of all of this. It's a difficult thing to do for community projects because basically the way the federal incentives are structured, they favor private developers in doing these projects. But if you're creative and you put your heads together, we were able to combine various programs using the investment tax credit and the RUS loan, the contingent promissory notes, in order to make this financially viable. A second lesson learned was related to the project sizing and design. I think that the idea that the Vinyl Haven and North Haven communities were using the power that they were generating was a very important thing. The idea of self-sufficiency and self-reliance, I think, resonates in many communities, particularly in island communities. The goal was not focused on energy export. Of course, there's some export due to intermittency, but that wasn't the primary goal here. And the idea of, you know, turning on a light switch, we always say you don't really know what electrons do. They do what they do, you don't know where they go. But the idea that, you know, you turn on your light switch on violently, and you know that if the wind's out there blowing, you know, there's a connection there. People, I think, feel proud of the fact that they're generating their own resource right there. Focus on the community, and community wind, of course, is important. The idea of defining what the community is sort of was a critical aspect of this project. The islands, like much of Maine, has a seasonal population to them, and it was very important that the vote that was taken for the project included both year-round and seasonal residents. And communication and updates have been important, you know, before the project came together, during construction, and now in terms of sharing power production updates and updates on other issues. Next. The local ownership and benefit, obviously a big part of community wind. I think it's been received quite well out there. The community owns and controls this project. The Fox Islands Wind LLC board that was set up for tax purposes is controlled by local stakeholders. They benefit through lower and stabilized electricity prices. Oftentimes, wind power projects communities will benefit from the added tax revenue that comes into a town. People can build sidewalks. The idea here that everybody sees a personal impact on their electric bill, I think, is important as well. The energy portion of the bill right now, which had been around 11, 12 cents a kilowatt hour, has been cut in half. So instead of paying 28, 29 cents a kilowatt hour, we're down to 24, 25, somewhere around there. And that's going to be locked in for the next 20 years, basically. So that stabilization, I think, is very important, as this community has seen a lot of volatility over the last few decades. The negative impacts. So two of the things Richard talked about, the visual impact. And that is something that I know we hear in Maine, sort of what these things look like and how they impact our view. And it's interesting that what we've seen on the Fox Islands is that we really haven't heard much in the way of complaints about the visual impact. I don't know if it helps that this project's in the middle of the island. Most people are facing the ocean. For them to see them, they have to look out their backyard, not their front yard. But we haven't really heard that part of it. As I'm sure many of you, you know, undoubtedly are aware of the sound concerns that have been raised by some of our neighbors out on Vinyl Haven that live close and, you know, various distances away from the turbines. It's a very interesting situation. It's unfortunate that those neighbors are having negative experiences. There are a number of neighbors who are living at various distances who are not having negative experiences. And so learning about sort of the individualized impacts of sound from wind turbines and trying to understand the technical aspects of this issue have been very interesting and challenging, but I think one of the things that the community, some people in the community feel pride in, is that the solution to this sound issue will be a community solution. The electric co-op is actively asking its members and the neighbors that are having issues about how this issue can be dealt with. We are looking to national renowned experts from the National Renewable Energy Lab that visited the site with us for 2 days earlier this week. We are doing a number of studies, gathering tons of data on the sound issues out there, and doing different modeling in terms of targeted curtailment. And, you know, I think we're learning a lot, and I think that we hope to be able to share this information with other communities looking at wind power going forward. Next. A couple of quick things I'm going to add in here is that an added benefit of the Fox Islands Wind Project, sort of broadening the benefits of the wind project, is this new project that we call Heating with Wind. You might have heard a little bit about it. A few months ago, the Island Institute partnered with the Island Energy Task Force, a community group on Vinyl Haven, to look at how we could use excess wind from the wind power project on Vinyl Haven that's normally sold to the mainland. How could we use it on the islands more affordably heat homes? In order to know when that excess power is available and to do it at a time when the price is right and when you need heat, we've been working with some experts to develop what we call a smart grid, basically with some specialized hardware, software, and pricing mechanisms so the heaters know when to turn on and off. And thus far, we've seen, we're not heating people's homes with this project so far, we're heating a few rooms, so we consider it to be supplemental heat. Thus far, we've been reducing heating costs for supplemental purposes by about 44 to 47% so far with this excess power. if things continue to go well, the community continues to be supportive, and we're able to attract the necessary funding next fall, we'd like to expand that pilot project to also include electric vehicles and perhaps even diesel electric hybrid lobster boats, so that we can use this power for other sources as well. Almost done. Is this a replicable process? Well, we've already started to use this process out on Monhegan, where they're paying 70 cents a kilowatt hour. The community there completed their phase one and had their vote last summer and voted in favor of moving forward with a much, much, much smaller project. But because Monhegan does not have a grid tie, it doesn't have a submarine cable, when they have excess power, they're going to need to find a way to use it. And so this heating project is a very promising way to do that. Swan's Island and Frenchboro are looking at a community project. They're basically at the beginning of their phase one right now. And one of the things that we've been talking to folks in this area about is how this model might be replicated on the mainland without your own electric cooperative, and how can you sort of talk about local benefit and local ownership. And so we've been talking to the Camden Energy Committee about how such a model, you know, as Richard said, it's very early stage, but sort of how would this even work sort of legally, financially? How would you structure the ownership model itself? Not even looking at how many turbines are where or how, but is there a way that the community can own this? Next. Obviously, offshore wind, which Habib will speak about this evening, is a big issue here in Maine, and I think part of what we're trying to talk about at the Island Institute is how to take this idea of public participation and community benefit to this new sector of wind power in Maine. And how can we talk about using this heat from wind project with excess power that might be generated from offshore wind? You may have heard the conversation that if we develop Maine's wind resource offshore, we'd have this excess amount of power. And some people say, well, what are we going to do? Send it to Boston? I don't want to do that. If you can develop these types of projects, you know, the state of Maine could be using that electricity for other purposes like heating and transportation as well. So I just like to close on this slide. At the Island Institute, we like to talk about how back in the 19th century, wind is what made this part of the country so rich and successful. And in the 20th century, we kind of turned our backs on the wind and looked at diesel engines and all this other fossil fuel stuff. But that in the 21st century, communities are sort of increasingly looking back to the wind to see what role it could play in their communities to make it more sustainable economically and ecologically. Thanks.
Super.